Crossword puzzles are a quintessential part of many newspapers. Most of us have tried to complete one, but if you're anything like me, you end up overconfidently filling in wrong answers in ink. During World War II, whole families would huddle in air raid shelters, distracting themselves from the bombs with crossword puzzles. However, one newspaper's crossword puzzles caused a huge security alert for British intelligence on the eve of the D-Day landings, when code words for the invasion started appearing frequently. They suspected Nazi agents. This is a story of the D-Day crosswords. Hi, and welcome back to the Historical Crimes and Criminals podcast. I'm Steve, your host. And it's a big thank you to people who have been supporting me on Ko-fi. The links are in the show notes. Thank you for the coffee. Thank you for the beers. It's much appreciated. Oh, what a tangled web we weave when we practice to deceive, said the writer Walter Scott. And for those employed in espionage, they sometimes see conspiracies everywhere. And this was never more exemplified than in the wonderful 1974 film, The Conversation, where we see Gene Hackman's surveillance expert slowly being driven mad with paranoid thoughts that he's also been spied on. But as we saw in earlier episodes of the podcast, it really was with World War II that the demand soared and resources put into espionage and counter-espionage. And the paranoia it bred led to even more cunning ways to outwit the enemy. One of Britain's ace cards was a stage illusionist. He was Jasper Maskelyne. Born into a family of established stage magicians in 1902, Maskelyne followed in the family's footsteps, carving out a fruitful career as a stage magician. Prior to World War II, Maskelyne was performing in London, and one of his most famous tricks, swallowing a handful of razor blades without ill effect, had crowds flocking to see his acts. When not swallowing sharp objects, he was also skilled in a range of tricks from sleight of hand, card, and rope tricks. When the war broke out, Maskelyne considered where he could utilise his considerable magical talents, and he decided that the camouflage unit might have a good place for him. But after meeting scepticism from every corner, he eventually got his own unit, and he nicknamed it the Magic Gang. And magic they did in North Africa. The main British naval base was Alexandria in Egypt, and it was a massive target for bombers. Maskelyne's role was to make the harbour disappear. What Maskelyne and the gang decided to do was fabricate a new whole harbour made from cardboard. This would serve as a decoy and draw the Luftwaffe's fire. Hundreds of soldiers were employed to help build the dummy harbour a few miles away at Merriott Bay. The faux harbour was not designed at full size, but to appear as though it was from aircraft high in the sky. This form of trickery was created to harness the perspective of the pilots, utilising shadows, ground lights and explosive charges to appear as if the location was under siege. When the next convoy of ships arrived, all the lights were turned off in Alexandria, and the lights were then turned on in Merriott. The decoy ships and lights were illuminated, and the bombs were detonated to appear to the other Luftwaffe pilots that the attack has begun. The illusion was a success, drawing the pilot's fire on the first night and then two more successive nights after that. This victory for Maskelyne's gang and the man himself cemented his ability, earned him a promotion, and his technique demonstrated the use of decoy installations in the war effort, utilising light shadows and dummy structures were used to disguise other naval bases too. After Alexandra Harbour, Maskelyne would go on to protect the vital supply route for the Allies at the Suez Canal by harnessing dazzle lights. These dazzle lights were a rotating structure of light constructed of mirrors and 24 powerful anti-aircraft searchlights. The brilliant show was supposed to have protected the Allies from being bombed and kept them safe. After the war, Maskelyne went back to stage magician, wrote a few books, settled in Kenya before dying in 1973. For the Codebreakers of Bletchley Park, on an interview, all of them loved the challenge of crossword puzzles. The world's first published crossword puzzle was created by Liverpool-born journalist Arthur Wins. This was on Sunday, December the 21st, 1913, and the New York World published a diamond-shaped puzzle. It slowly evolved to the style we know now, and by the late 1920s, crossword puzzles were a staple for every newspaper in the world. With the blackouts and the wartime restrictions, they were at their most popular during World War II. And during World War II, the British public were repeatedly warned through propaganda that spies could be everywhere, and it was to this end we saw such posters warning that loose lips sink ships. Espionage, counter-espionage was everywhere, and every small detail would be suspected. Paranoid people were everywhere. On August 18th, 1942, the word Dieppe had appeared in the Daily Telegraph crossword. And only a day afterward, on the 19th, the Allies launched a raid on the French port of Dieppe. British intelligence were aware of this. They held a case conference, but put it down to mere coincidence. By 1944, the tide of the war had swung in the Allies' favour, and troops were massed in the south of England, ready for the invasion of France. It became a game of poker between Allies and the Axis. There were only two realistic landing options for the invasion, Pas-de-Calais or Normandy, and not enough resources to defend both. Intelligence services on both sides were desperately involved in bluffs and double bluffs, with the Allies using innovations as inflatable tanks in East Anglia that, from the air, the German planes taking photographs showed mass tanks waiting to be deployed to Calais. The French invasion was called Operation Overlord, with the amphibious part of the landings given the codename Neptune. It was scheduled for June the 5th, 1944, and involved a series of joint air and sea landings along the Normandy coast. Rather than mass themselves at one spot, they were to land at five different areas according to nationality. The Americans were to land at two places, the first on the left bank of the Douve Estuary, codenamed Utah Beach. The second was a stretch including Saint-Laurent-sur-Mer, codenamed Omaha. The British troops were given two landing sites, first along Saint-Aubin-sur-Mer, codenamed Sword, as well as the beach near Le Hamel, codenamed Gold. The Canadians were assigned the beach near Saint-Aubin. This was codenamed Juno. To ensure the quick offloading of cargo, portable bridges called Mulberry Harbours were built. They were essentially floating harbours. Ships would tow these to France, assemble them at sea, and then drive equipment onto the beaches. Security was essential And it was into this, the Allies' heightened sense of paranoia, that we begin the story. In early 1944, the words Juno, gold, and sword appeared in the Daily Telegraph crossword puzzles as solution words. Although eyebrows were raised at Whitehall, at the time these were considered common words in crosswords, so they were largely ignored by intelligence agencies as a mere coincidence. However, just about 1 month before the invasion, on the 2nd of May 1944, the word Utah appeared in the crossword as a solution to the clue, one of the US. Utah, another coincidence. Eyebrows at MI5 were well and truly raised 20 days later when the word Omaha also appeared in the crossword puzzle. And then on the 27th of May, the crossword clue was Bigwig, providing the answer of Overlord, the codename for the entire Normandy operation. 3 days later, Mulberry appeared, the codename for the floating harbours. On June the 1st, a matter of days before the operation was to be launched, the word Neptune appeared as a solution word. This was the name given to the amphibious assault. Whitehall was buzzing by this time. Was this an agent sending messages to the Germans? The War Office sent Lods Tweedsmuir, a senior intelligence officer, to investigate, and he concluded it was a complete fluke. Were the D-Day words just a case of déjà vu, or something more sinister? But MI5 wasn't taking any chances, and went in search for the author of the suspicious crosswords. It led them to Strand School in Effingham, Surrey, to the office of the headmaster, Leonard Daw. The 54-year-old teacher juggled his full-time job alongside a passion for creating crosswords for the Daily Telegraph. Daw had been born in Brentford, West London, in 1889. He studied at Cambridge and earned his blue against Oxford at football in 1912. And for you that don't know, a blue is a coveted university honour, which means that you've competed at the highest level of university sport. We think of the annual boat race. Each of the crew is said to have earned their blue by competing, and the blue is indeed a distinct blazer and tie. British elitism, indeed. Anyway, after Cambridge, he played football for Southampton and was in the British squad for the 1912 Olympic Games. But he left sport behind for a career in academia. By 1926, he had joined the Strand School in South London and eventually became the head teacher. In 1925, he started compiling crossword puzzles for the Daily Telegraph. During World War II, the school was evacuated to Effingham in Surrey, and it was to this end that in 1944, the school was surrounded by a massive build-up of Canadian and American troops preparing for the long-awaited invasion of Europe. Two MI5 agents escorted Dawes off the premise and into the custody, where they held him for the next few days, grilling him about his recent choice of crossword clues. "They turned me inside out," Dawes would later say in a 1958 interview with the BBC. "Then they went to Bury St Edmunds, where my senior colleague Melville Jones, another crossword compiler for the newspaper, was living. They put him through the grill as well, but in the end, they eventually decided not to shoot us after all. Had D-Day failed, they might have changed their minds." And the story emerged. On the 40th anniversary of the D-Day landings in 1984, the Daily Telegraph decided to retell the story with the coincidental crossword incident. Ronald French, a property manager from Wolverhampton, happened to read the article and got in touch with the paper with some intriguing information. It turned out French was a pupil at the Strand School back in 1944. Daw used to invite the students into his study to help him with the crosswords. He'd ask them to write words onto a blank crossword, which he'd later provide clues for, French says he assisted the headmaster in this way on multiple occasions. He went on to state that he may have even been the one who inserted the D-Day codewords into the crossword. As at that time the school was in an area littered with American and Canadian forces, French said he learned the words from soldiers. French went on to say that him and most of the other children just hung around the nearby military camps. "I was totally obsessed about the whole thing," he told the Daily Telegraph. "I would play truant from school to visit camp, and I used to spend my evenings with them and whole weekends there, dressed in my army cadet uniform. Everyone knew the outline invasion plan, and they knew the various code words." French kept a notebook detailing all he heard. French said that after D-Day, Doss sent for him and questioned him about the code names. French told the headmaster where he'd heard the words from, and even owned up to writing it all down in his notebook, which was ordered to be destroyed. Tom Weston, head boy of Dawes School at the time, also recalled the day that MI5 came to the school. "An official-looking car turned up," he recalled. "I was interested, but I kept watching. And after a time, I saw Mr. Daw going off in the car with whoever he was." And one of his colleagues at the Telegraph said about the whole event, "We were astonished at the thought that Daw was a traitor. After all, he was a member of our local golf club." Leonard Daw continued to compile crosswords for the Daily Telegraph until his death in 1963. Well, that's it for another episode of the Historical Crimes and Criminals podcast. I hope you enjoyed that one. You'll find my links to Ko-fi on today's show notes. And until next time, bye-bye.